So this is the third group this morning. My voice is getting a bit weary, but you'll be the best group. The last group is always the best group. Just in terms of requirements, what I say here, just come over here a bit so we're not blocking the passageway. My suggested aim is that you select one Australian painting from each of the main categories that we walk around. That includes Indigenous art. I haven't got that written down here, but that's another category. And to think about how, make notes, and to think about how that painting might be linked to literary ideas that we are studying this semester. And I've actually put in this clause that I'm insisting that in your final exam you have to make reference to visual art, at least one piece of visual art, and the question is framed so that it allows you to talk about that. Now I'm going to, wherever I can, make cross-references to the literature, either in terms of its themes or in terms of its methods. But there's more that can be said than I can say, and there's a room for you to explore and to think about this more fully. There are areas where you might be thinking, what's this got to do with literature? Well, in a sense, that's where you can make the leap and see if you can make the connection. Because all art is interconnected. In any historical period, what you see in painting is reflected in literature, is reflected in music. So I'm just trying to use this opportunity in teaching you literature to make you, not only to make you aware of the art that was produced at the time, but to support your study of literature by showing how its themes and ideas expanded to the other arts, and hopefully that kind of gives you an enriched view of what's happening in the literature. So standing right where you are, turn 180 degrees, and we stand here in front of one, two, three, four paintings by John Glover. John Glover is the artist who painted, I think I've shown you a couple of times, a painting called My House and Garden. And I was using it as an example to show the opposite of Judith Wright's declaration, the mountain has its own meaning. One of the themes I was pursuing was the way that early settlers, and particularly the early explorers, tended to see the place as open for civilization, as, you know, ready for the plow, ready for cattle, and so on and so forth. And that tended to predispose them to look at the landscape as if it were Europe, as if it didn't have any of the, you know, hard edges that would deter investors and visitors to come out of here. So John Glover's a little bit in that category, and I suppose this painting here shows something of that. This is the house that was painted in his painting My House and Garden from a different perspective. But the landscape is tame, filled with cattle. The artist himself is sitting in the corner reflecting over his property. It kind of breathes a land ready for civilization. Above, it's more of a woodland scene, but again, it's not a dangerous world that's presented. The artist and his wife are sitting there next to each other with their little dog running into the distance. I don't know if you can see that little white flake. That's suggesting something almost of a very romantic, and I'm talking romantic here, romantic literature. Their view of the landscape as a place where you could meditate, come in touch with your soul, and so on and so forth. This is one view of the landscape. We can't leave without looking at this one here. This was done by John Glover as well, around the same time, but it's more of a historical painting of the Indigenous inhabitants in Tasmania. Now it's actually said that when, and I don't know if this is true or not, but when Glover painted this picture, you wouldn't have seen Indigenous people like that. Here they're painted, as it were, in their natural condition before European society came and overwhelmed them. And it's said that by 1838 there would have been very few Aboriginals left, certainly not many living in that kind of way. So this might be a historical painting describing what they were like 20 or 30 years before he painted it. What's worth commenting on is the way that he, like many early Australian artists, had not yet found a way of depicting the gum tree as we recognise it. These are very weird looking gum trees. They don't conform at all to what we might see as a gum tree, and you'll see the difference in the next room when we go there. So what I've just showed you is sort of one half of the way that the landscape was seen by the early Australian writers and artists. The other way was quite the opposite. It was to see the landscape as threatening, as overwhelming, as dwarfing human beings to almost nothing. That didn't mean that it wasn't beautiful, but it had a different sort of intention behind it to these sorts of landscapes. Let's have a look at a couple of them. So here are two, and there's another two on the wall over there which we'll go and have a look at in a moment. But these two are by Eugène von Gérard, a very Germanic name. He was actually from Switzerland. And, you know, most of the artists, all of the artists, except the indigenous ones, have of course been born in Europe, have been trained in Europe. So what they brought with them was their European glasses. Now this, radically different to what we've seen in John Glover. Can anybody see the human figure in that painting? Yeah. So tiny you don't see it unless it's pointed out to you. So the human figure is kind of dwarfed into nothing by this incredible majestic landscape that, you know, is a threatening landscape if one doesn't know how to deal with it. So, you know, you could, many of these paintings were produced to be sent back home, to be shown to the Europeans. The landscape was a formidable but an exciting and exotic landscape. It was often a situation. Here's another one, look. Two tiny figures, not as small as over there, but waterfall in Strath Creek. So the Australian landscape is this overpowering force. Even more, go on, yes, Ben?
How were these paintings received when they were sent back to England? What was the, from Eugène's perspective?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. I can't answer that definitely, but there have been studies done of the reception of these paintings in Europe, and you know how the South Pacific was perceived in Europe, what the intention was behind the artists, whether they were attracting people to come here, whether they were selling the country for its exotic quality. Tourism wasn't yet a big industry; it took too long to get out here, but they, certainly they were wanting settlers out here, in addition to the convicts that were coming out every year. So I haven't answered your question directly. So over here, look. You know this one?
I already saw it before. That time.
You saw it before?
Yeah.
Why did you see it before? You were in a previous group.
Oh, no. I was here before you guys came. That's fine.
Good. Okay, good. You're drawn towards this painting.
Yeah.
Why?
Because just the colours that we use.
Yeah.
And just the difference. Just like, it's very realistic.
Yeah. Yeah. Good, good, good observations. It is extremely realistic. And in fact, if you go close to it, you'll see that almost every stone and blade of grass in the front is painted with incredible accuracy. And one of the reasons for that is it was a post-Darwinian painting. Darwin's theory of evolution, his interest in scientific data, that was something that kind of really affected 19th century observations of landscape. And that's past John Glover. He wasn't in that world yet. So there's an incredibly scientific interest here, but that doesn't overwhelm the almost religious sense of the grandeur of nature as being God's domain. And, you know, you pointed out the colours, those incredible pink clouds, those spiky mountains. There is something awesome about that. And again, you've got these tiny little figures, look, with a little boat over here, a larger vessel over here, and these little figures in the front here. So quite an amazing representation of nature as perceived by mid-19th century. Painting next to it in the same kind of tradition, but this is the Blue Mountains. This is the Nepean River. It's called the Upper Nepean by Pigwenny. And again, the Blue Mountains presented as a sort of an exotic frightening place and yet exciting. You've got, look at this tiny figure again in the front here, wrestling with the rocks going round one corner to the next. Yeah, it would be. So, this is the early 19th century. Now, the other end of this room is sort of the mid to late 19th century. But the late 19th century sort of divides into two for important reasons that I'll tell you about once you've been in this next room. Okay, so we're looking at this painting of gum trees to begin with. Now, I deliberately pointed out the oddly formed gum trees in the Glover painting down at the other end of the room. The gum trees here are not oddly formed, they're very close to the way we might see them. This is the Sydney red gum, the Angophora costata. Please don't take that down. But the question I've got is, you know, what is this artist expressing about the gum tree? 1906 this was. What flavor does it have? What is the feeling that is expressed? What is driving him to produce this painting, would you say?
Like the features, like he wants.
Not the features. I'm thinking more of the feeling, more of the attitude, more of the value.
More of like less of a British sort of like perspective.
Yeah, less of a British perspective. Yeah. That's something like that. You want to build on that? Other thoughts?
With the other painting, yep. You say how the branches are more curvy.
Yeah.
These ones are more, I don't
know how to
explain it.
Isn't that the whole idea? I think we were saying in a lecture of one of the tutorials, the Aboriginals were looked at as kind of rough or untouched perhaps, or,
yep.
You know, and that kind of comes out in that because it's just so, the texture,
yep.
It's just they, yeah, that's
more edgy.
More
edgy?
Okay, yep. Okay, let's keep a few more thoughts together.
Would it be more to do with a more complete understanding of Australia as a landscape? Because back there, you know, they didn't see the trees as important.
Yep.
Whereas here, it's the main foreground. It's the most important.
So that's an important idea. The trees are here being presented as something really main, as something really important. Any other thoughts? Tabitha. Formidable, strength, landmarks, all those things. Very good, Tabitha, yep. Hi! You made it! Before we finished. Have you got all the documents? Do you want some? Yes, please. You want a pencil as well? You've got a pencil. Good girl. Can I add a few words to what you've said? What I get from this painting, I get this overwhelming feeling I want to rush up there and hug those gum trees. Now, why has she done that to me? She's done it because she's in awe of this amazing landscape and these trees. I mean, look at the bloody scale of the thing. You know, the size of it. I mean, this is a person who's really trying to sell you something that's important and valuable about the Australian landscape. It's full of awe, it's full of wonder, full of majesty and full of sunlight. But not the sort of sunlight we're going to see in the next room, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But if you look at these paintings, 1, 2, 3, 4 here, they're all kind of majestically embracing the awesome size and grandeur of Australia. And what years was this? This was 1890, 1900, 1905. What was happening in Australia at this time? Historically. Nationalism. We were becoming a nation. Australia was becoming it on its own. It was going to be have its own nationality. It was still going to be part of the Commonwealth, but Australia was going to have its own parliament, etc., etc. So there was a lot of positive feeling about nationhood happening, and that kind of must have underlay some of the inspiration of some of his art. We went down that first room, and you can listen to it all on here afterwards, all right? So along with the national pride in landscapes, there also began increasingly an interest in Australian experiences that were distinctive and were not like what you got in Europe. So here, for example, from a distant land, here is a poor chap who's got a letter delivered by the postman on horseback. The letter written by his girlfriend how many months ago? 3 or 4 months. And he's reading the letter and he thinks, does she still love me? Is she going out with anybody else? How can I be sure? If I write to her back now, when's she going to get the letter? You know, he didn't have the opportunity that we have now with our, you know, we can go in here and say, do you love me? Are you going out with anybody else? We know immediately. Are we going to Facebook? Am I still your friend, etc.? But not here. There's a different world. So, from a distant land, you know, there was a book written, a history book by Geoffrey Blainey, I think it was, called The Tyranny of Distance, which kind of summarized the Australian experience. And you get that in Henry Lawson's stories, in Banjo Paterson's poems, in Barbara Bateman's stories. A lot of the literature that was happening around the 1890s, 1900s was sort of talking about evoking some of the distinctive qualities of the Australian experience. But the other thing that is important to try and understand, and it might become more apparent in the next room, is that just as Australian literature, like Australian painting, was beginning to show its Australian national flavour in its subject matter, so the language was beginning to change, just like the art language was beginning to change from sort of strange gum trees to something that was more realistic to our eyes. In the language, with Henry Lawson, you no longer had him talking what was the English word for creeks that Mitchell used? He talked about the rivulet or the stream?
Was it brook?
Brook, it was brook, that's the one. In Henry Lawson, you'd never get the brook referred to, it'd always be the creek, mate, the creek. Brook. So Australian language began to develop its vocabulary just like Australian painting developed its vocabulary in paint. So quite a lot of these paintings depict the sorts of experience that people had in the late 19th century. Up here, I just want to point out this fellow here. We've had the art gallery visit this time before we've studied Lawson. That's just the way the calendar worked out. Normally we have the gallery visit after we've read Lawson, and when that happens I ask people to come to this here and genuflect in front of the painting. But we don't do it today. We haven't read his stories yet. We haven't yet acquired the honour that his name needs. That's a load of bullshit, by the way. Henry Lawson was in 1900, he was an achieved author. He'd got a contract for publishing in London. But about 4 years later, he was on the streets of Sydney as an alcoholic. And he ended up in jail, had a lawsuit against him from his wife. His life became a mess. He tended to blame the Australian government as not supporting artists and writers. But his story is a very sad story, despite the fact that his writing was so brilliant. We'll talk more about that when we look at him in a week or so. If you go out of the gallery and turn right, go down Mrs. Macquarie's chair, about 100 metres on the right-hand side, there's a statue that was put there at the time of his funeral, together with his dog. It's worth having a look at that if you have time. Now, every painting that we've looked at so far was done in a studio. That was what was typical of paintings in the 19th century. What happened at the end of the 19th century, there was a group of artists in Melbourne. They called themselves the Heidelberg School Artists. They were Tom Roberts, Arthur Streeton, Fred McCubbin, Julian Ashton, and there were some others. And why they became so important was because as a group, they decided to go to France to study painting because they'd been hearing that in France there were all these new developments for painting, impressionism, but also painting out of doors. And painting out of doors was a bit of a revelation for them. How could you take a canvas and paint out of doors? In Australia, you'd get eaten by flies. But in France, they discovered that you could do that. And then they came back to Australia and they didn't find Aerogard back then, but they discovered citronella. You could rub on your skin and stop the mozzies biting you, so they could paint out of doors as well. And when they painted out of doors, what happened? What happened to the light? Any guesses? Brighter, that's right. And impressionism led them to realize that you could capture the impression of things just as well by capturing light on surfaces as you could going in and defining every little detail like our friend Eugene von Gerard and his Morph of Sound did. So in this next room, the Heidelberg School, the turn of the century school, it's most famous for its the light that it brought in, but also its Australian themes. And it's, you know, this, a lot of Australian art, in a sense, gets its name through this particular school. Let's go over and have a look. First of all, the cabinet on which I'm leaning, and which I shouldn't be leaning on because I'll be told off by a guard in a minute, has got in it paintings that were painted on cigar box lids. And if you just have a little look at them for a moment, come a bit closer and have a look at the cigar box lids. These are paintings that were part of what was called the 9x5 exhibition. 9x5 is the dimensions of a cigar box lid. And these Heidelberg School artists who were into impressionist painting, that is not painting every detail, they wanted to capture the impression of various things. They had a very radical revolutionary exhibition. Many people came and said, that's not painting, anybody can do that, as they always do when a new school of artists comes along. But they made their name with this 9x5 exhibition. But if you turn around, or that some of you who are standing next to me don't need to turn around, but the rest of you turn 180 degrees, directly in front of us, in the big gold frame, is a painting by Arthur Streeton called Fires on Lapston Tunnel. The Lapston Tunnel is the tunnel in the Blue Mountains that was dug out when they began the Blue Mountains Railway. And you live in Lapston?
Yeah.
Wow, that's good. Do you want to go down and look at the start of the tunnel, see if you can recognise that scene at all? Can you recognise it at all?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
You think you can?
When you go, yeah, there's like a little tunnel where you're going. Like,
you're right.
Station, yeah.
Right, fantastic. So you can see the sky there. Now, you never saw the sky like that in the other room. So the sky has been painted from outdoors. It's got the intensity, and the light on the rocks has got the intensity of a landscape seen out of doors. Now, if we went closer to that painting, you'd see that the detail is nowhere near like the detail in the 19th century painting, but still everything is there and very vividly there. But there's a theme in this painting that's central to literature as well as to Australian art. And the theme is the contrast between man's impact on the landscape and nature's ruling of the landscape. So on the right-hand side, you've got all the destructiveness of human activity. And in fact, the story, if you go closer, you can see there's a young man being brought out on a stretcher from that tunnel. He's been killed by falling rock. and he's going to be carried up to the group of men on the right-hand side. You can just see a red flag there that's been hoisted because of someone has died. In contrast to that, when you get a bit closer, you can't see it too well from here. But in the landscape on the left-hand side, there's lots of red dots at the top. Go closer and see if you can find them.
What was the contrast?
Contrast between the human impact on the landscape and nature, as it were, unimpacted by human activity. Can anybody see the red spots in the top? What are they? Any guesses? Anybody been into the bush in the last week? Not fancier. What's out at the moment? Have you seen them in the bush around Lapston? No. The waratahs don't come out till November, but at the moment the Gymea lilies that look similar, but they're bigger. It would be waratahs if it was November, but the actual shape of those flowers is more Gymea lily-ish. But it shows that nature is kind of alive and filled with its own autonomy, and this landscape is being completely brutalized by man's activity. So there's still parts of Lapson that do look like that. So if you just move back about 2 meters, back that way, 2 meters. So on this wall here, we've got all the major Heidelberg artists. Here you've got Fred McCubbin. And this is called On the Wallaby Track. And it's a very iconic nationalist painting about pioneers, pioneering. Here's the husband and wife and the baby. And he's about to, there's a tent in the background, but he's about to build their first cottage. In Melbourne, there's a triptych. Triptych means three paintings in a series that takes this story further. He's built his cottage. The village is being built and the town is in the distance. The bush here is being painted, you know, very scrubby, and if you look closely, it doesn't have any of the detail next door, but it's got the feel of the authentic kind of bush about it. Now, you have to say, however, that with this interest in nationalistic themes, there also began to be some idealization. What does that mean? Idealization. What does that mean? If you idealize something, what do you do to it? Yeah, you make it put more perfect. You use it to glorify something or to make it bigger than it is. And, you know, I wonder how many ladies in the bush would have looked quite so fulsome and the baby so rich. I mean, you know, they look like they've been feasting on Maccas for the last 4 weeks. Not Maccas, sorry, that was the wrong choice of word. Feasting on, you know, wonderful, substantial sustenance. Very un-Macca, you know. So, look at this one here too. This one here, now this is Tom Roberts. Tom Roberts. He was, you know, with Streeton, he was one of the main Heidelberg school. Forget about the central subjects for the moment and look at the bush. It's filled with sunlight. It looks like the bush we know. We've sort of grown used to seeing the bush in that way. But not great on detail, but you don't need it. The Impressionists had a real ability to evoke the way we see landscape without noticing the detail. Because we don't see the detail, in fact. When you look at things, we see a very kind of a blurred picture, usually. But now, let's look at the subject matter. What is the subject here? What's being painted? Sorry? People on horses, yep. In a carriage, yep. What? Bush rangers. Very good. The painting is actually called Baled Up. Baled up means is when you've been, you know, bailed up by bush rangers. Here are the poor guys here. They've had all their money taken out of their pockets. They're not even being given a cup of tea in exchange. They've just been told to sit there quietly, and I'm holding my gun at you. Give us all your stuff, money or your life. So Tom Roberts was a bit of a radical, daring to present a bushranging event as the centerpiece of a painting that hangs in a gallery. I mean, you know, this is radical stuff. And it picks up what I have mentioned a few weeks ago about Ned Kelly and the reception in Australia of the whole anti-authoritarian convict strand. You know, we Australians hated the British who dominated us here. We Irish, we stuck together, and we, you know, we felt that our way of looking at the world was the right way. So Ned Kelly, for example, began to become a saint in people's eyes, something like a Robin Hood hero figure. So that was what was happening in the 1900s, the turn of the century. And come down this way a little bit. So here is Tom Roberts. I was talking about idealization before. So this is the shearing sheds. Now, you know, an unsympathetic person nowadays would say, this is a picture of tradies. You know, tradies, those guys who come and rip you off for $160 an hour to repair your sewage pipe or what have you. The world is full of tradies who earn more money than we'll ever earn. But they're ignorant. But did Tom Roberts think these were tradies? No way. What do these men look like? Hardworking. Sorry? You think they look like lower class? Why do you think that? Because of the job they have. Okay, but do they look lower class? Go, tell us what you think.
Well, the clothes that they have on, it's not that bad. Like, if it was lower class, they wouldn't.
That's what you got? Yep.
Yeah, look at this, and I look at the Aussie battler.
Yep. Yep, so are they presented as heroic figures or not? They all look about 7'2" each. Do you know what the painting's called? It's called The Golden Fleece. Now, if you look up The Golden Fleece in Google, there's a whole kind of Greek mythology around the Golden Fleece. Well, it's obviously then a painting about the wealth that accrues from shearing sheep. But it's also about it's a bit like the painting from Fred McCubbin, something like the strength, the masculinity, celebration of this distinctively Australian way of life. Maybe a bit like this one here, the gold panner. This is Julian Ashton. I mean, if you were actually on the gold fields and you were sharing a cup of tea with some of the gold panners there, would they look like that? They wouldn't. This man looks like sort of a Greek god almost. There's lots of other things we could talk about. There's cityscapes by the Heidelberg School, Redfern Station, Circular Quay, Sydney Harbour, and their wonderful impressions of early city landscapes. And this here, this is the same period, but not by one of the Heidelberg School. This is by Datilo Rubo, and it just shows us that at this time there was also an interest in social justice and issues of equity. This is called Poverty Makes Strange Bedfellows, and this was the time of the early depression in the early 20th century in Australia, and you've got all these various classes grouped together on a park bench somewhere in Sydney, the homeless people. Now, if you turn 180 degrees down to the other end of the gallery, that's part of the gallery we're not going to go to. It's forbidden. You can see why it's forbidden. It's full of things you shouldn't look at. But what is down there, in fact, is a whole group of artists who turned their back on the Australian bush, and they turned their back on nationalist themes. And they decided they would go to Europe, and they would paint in the French salon, and they would take on board all the sort of high society of early 20th century France. the main artist down there is Rupert Bunny, but there's also, I can't remember his other name. No. So anyway, that's a part we sort of fenced off from us, but you can go and have a look at it later. But we're going to go now to the early 20th century, where modernism began to have its impact. And modernism was quite different to what we've seen here. Modernism, under the impact of modernist art in Europe, began to look at the world very unphotographically. And there was a lot of experimentation with colour and form, as in the literature of the period. When we come and look at the literature of David Malouf, for example, and some of the short story writers of the 1920s and the 30s, a lot of experimentation with language, similar to the experimentation with painting techniques. Let's go. So that's right. That's right. And in fact, the painting just around the corner here, which we just have a look, take a quick look around here. This one kind of proves exactly what you're suggesting. I mean, it's an absolutely beautiful painting, Elliot Gruner's Spring Frost, set in the Southern Highlands. Just magnificent. In terms of its aesthetic beauty at springtime with the cherry blossoms coming up. It's very European, could almost be anywhere in Europe, but as you suggest, it suggests the humanization. This is a very rural landscape, a landscape that would be very enticing for anyone to move into. So that's certainly true there. That's done in 1919. Now this is not a modernist painting, far from it. This is very traditional in its techniques. But here on this other wall, we get a lot of modernism. Just stop there, Tabitha. So, on this wall here, there are two main artists, and we're going to see more of their work a bit later on. But one, two, three, four there are Grace Cossington Smith. Grace Cossington Smith, one of the early women modernists, one of the first experimenters. This painting here, Implement Blue, was cited as one of the earliest modernist paintings in Australia. Its interest in the formal beauty and shape and interest in texture. Her picture of the Harbour Bridge, she did a number of the Harbour Bridge while it was being built. There's one huge painting of hers with the half the arm in the air and the other half not built yet. It was used as the advertisement for a recent exhibition of Australian modernism that they had on here. And this one, a cafe in David Jones in 1936 called the Lacquer Room. And, you know, what's she interested in? She's interested in the texture of the colour of the paint on the chairs, very odd stylized faces of people that capture something of the alienation of what it is to live in a city. So Grace Cossington Smith, her experimentation with colour and form and shape. The other four paintings there, one, two, three, four, five, the other five paintings, are from Margaret Preston. Margaret Preston, I've shown you already, she painted the indigenous Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and the indigenous Adam and Eve who were cast out of the Garden of Eden by a white angel. I can show you another of her paintings which shows her interest in Aboriginality in a moment, but just here, this is a self-portrait, and interestingly she portrays herself next to a pot with Christmas bells in it. Christmas bells are an iconic Australian native plant. You'll see them in the bush around about December. And here is her gum nuts. Here are her gum flowers. So those three suggest her passionate interest in native flora, which is not something that many people were interested in at that time. People were still filling their gardens with roses and daffodils and European plants, and she was sort of pushing her way into a more appreciation of Australian things, but she was using very modernist techniques to do that. Let's keep going around this way. So in this corner over here is another painting by Margaret Preston, and this is a view from where she lived in Barara. But what's interesting about this painting is that she has attempted to blend together the European way of painting, which she was trained in, with the Aboriginal way of painting. And how's she done that? Well, the painting, sorry? The outlining, yeah, absolutely. The outlining is very much like the Aboriginal work that we'll see when we go around to the next gallery. But the perspective is European, where you can see near things in the front and you can see the landscape receding into the distance. So it's a very significant painting from the point of view of literary and art history. You remember me talking about the Jindi Warrabaks. I don't know if you do remember that. Judith Wright was a Jindi Warrabak, so was Russell Drysdale. And the Jindi Warrabaks were artists and writers who attempted to consciously bring together indigenous and European ways of seeing the world. This was a real kind of act of trying to, you know, bring together what had been separated by a very cruel history over 150 years. So she was in the vanguard of that, very important for being so. Her paintings about the indigenous Adam and Eve, and also the indigenous Adam and Eve being cast out of the Garden of Eden, were all part of that same impulse that she had in that work. Now, over here on the other side of the wall, just stand where you are, there's this portrait by Dobell, William Dobell. And just worth mentioning to you that there was great controversy about this with reference to the Archibald Prize. And the Archibald Prize is actually on in this gallery at the moment. If you go down to the next floor, you can go and pay $7 or whatever and have a look at the Archibald Prize, which people flock to each year because it's a big exhibition, big competition of portraits, often portraits of celebrated people that you would know about in the media, etc., etc. William Dobell, one of Australia's great portrait artists, but he caused incredible controversy because he submitted this painting to the Archibald Prize. And the Archibald judges, back then in 1948, said, that's not a portrait, that's a caricature. How can you say that's a portrait? And Dobell said, that is a portrait. That is what I see when I see her. I'm seeing inside her mind, her spirit. I'm not just seeing her exterior. But there was a huge court case about this. And the Australian Art Society divided on this. There was, you know, furor. It showed how conservative Australia was, unable to accept that this could be a portrait. Eventually, Dobell won, but it really divided the Australian artistic community. If you go into the Archibald Prize now, you see lots of paintings that are far more, you know, radical than this one. Come around this way. So I'm sure you remember me showing you this painting, Russell Drysdale, The Walls of China. Really odd title. You wonder, Walls of China, what the hell has that got to do with it? Until you look it up and find out that actually what the walls of China are is this sandhill dunes in the background. If you live out at Broken Hill, apparently they all know what the walls of China are. It's these sand dunes that are some kilometers away from the city. But what's interesting here is that a little bit like Tom Roberts's Bailed Up, where you've got the bush rangers plunked into the middle of the Australian landscape, here you've got this twisted tree trunk plunked into the middle of the landscape. It's sort of a daring thing to do, to present a landscape with what seems to be not a central focus. At least it was daring when he did this. And, you know, Drysdale is the artist who was trying to, a bit like Margaret Preston, tune into the indigenous spirit in the landscape. And, you know, he does that both through his use of colour. The texture of his landscapes are earth colours, just like indigenous art. And he's trying to tune into something of the mystery and symbolism of the world that he's depicting. All these paintings are by Drysdale along here, not this one. This one over here is a landscape from a surrealist artist, James Gleeson. Surrealism based on dreams, but this is a painting done in 1944 in the middle of the Second World War, showing Europe tearing itself apart. But here are three paintings by Drysdale of Aboriginal people. And these are Aboriginal people who have been enculturated into white society, but they look a bit uncomfortable in their clothes, but they also look like a pretty stable family group. Drysdale was really interested in presenting and preserving images of the indigenous peoples. There was a painting by Drysdale in here a week ago which contrasted these with a Western family. And the Western family looked very dysfunctional compared to these. It's not here though, so I can't show you it. Over here, one of the things that you find in modern literature increasingly is people moving away from representing just the surface of things and trying to get deeper into the experience behind the surface. That's very characteristic of modern literature. When we do 20th century literature next year, we'll find a lot of writers and artists who do just that. And I think that can be applied to these two paintings here. Now, these were done by Grace Cossington Smith, who we saw in the other room. She was the one who did the Harbour Bridge and did the Implement Blue and did the Lacquer Room, the coffee shop in David Jones. Now, in later life, she moved into her parents' house. Her parents died in Taramara, and she lived the rest of her life on her own in Taramara in her parents' house. And she painted many paintings like this, all of her room or her rooms. This one is called Interior with Wardrobe Mirror. And you can get drawn into this painting if you allow yourself to... It's like, well, where is the person? But it's the person seeing that. It's like almost a reflection of the person. It's called Interior with Wardrobe Mirror, and it's a painting of an inside of a room. But I like to think that this interior is more like the interior of the artist. And, you know, we are sort of defined by the space that we live in. You know, if anybody walks into your bedroom, they'll immediately know it's your bedroom, because everything about you is reflected in the chaos in there. So, you know, we are our interiors. And I don't know, but these paintings, they really got some kind of unearthly quality of scraping away the surface and kind of looking inside. And this one's very warm and this is not so warm. So it's interesting how art operates, what art can do in terms of even reflecting our own reality. Let's move over this way. okay, we saw Tom Roberts has bailed up the picture of the bush rangers. Well, here is the bush ranger, the bush ranger. This is Ned Kelly. Ned Kelly as painted by Sidney Nolan. And if you go to the National Gallery in Canberra, there's a whole room full of Nolan paintings of Ned Kelly. He did about 50 of them, the whole history of the Ned Kelly story. He's obsessed with Ned Kelly. And this is the part of the story where Ned Kelly got some old plough equipment and turned it into a suit of armour, which he made. He riveted it together. And he's in his homemade suit of armour there, ready to protect himself against the invading policeman. And Sidney Nolan paints the bush, not with any attention to realism, but with attention to the magic, the mystery, the glory of the landscape, as he does in these other paintings down here. But what does Ned Kelly think about, what does Sidney Nolan think about Ned Kelly? Well, with his strange eyes peering out here, is Ned Kelly a hero for Sidney Nolan? Or is Sidney Nolan reflecting on the way that Australians have turned him into a hero? These are all questions that, you know, can be answered. There have been dramatic texts and poems written about Ned Kelly as well, so this painting doesn't exist in isolation. Ned Kelly as a legend, as a story, is in both literature and in painting. Now, this room here is all Sidney Nolan. Sidney Nolan is one of the the most internationally famous of Australian modern artists. And along with Sidney Nolan, first of all, let's have a quick look at this. Sidney Nolan was interested in Australian history and what it revealed about the Australian nation. This history here is the history of exploration. Just like we had Mitchell talking about his tour through Victoria, Burke and Wills, they travelled from Melbourne up to the Gulf of Carpentaria. Sidney Nolan did a whole lot of different pictures of Burke and Wills, and he wasn't simply recording history, just like when he did the Ned Kelly painting. He wasn't simply recording history. It was a kind of reflection or comic commentary. And, you know, one can begin to see here that this picture of Burke and Wills done in 1949, of an expedition that happened in 1849, well, this character here is sort of wringing their hands and saying, what the bloody hell am I doing here? How did I get here? What the hell is this? I should be back in Melbourne, sitting with my wife having a cup of tea, and here I am strapped to the top of this camel. Bloody hell, what's going on? You know, there's a certain sort of weird sense of alienation, misplacedness about that character on that camel. Incidentally, we're all eating camel meat now in the local newspaper. They're making camel sausages. They're apparently very, very tasty and good for you, full of vitamin E. So, any comment at all about this painting? If you were asked to say, what does Sidney Nolan think about the history of Australian exploration, what might you say? Yep.
I just have a question. Is he Uluru? Because it sort of looks like
him. Very interesting. No, it's not Uluru because Burke and Wills never went to Uluru.
Okay.
But there are other landscape features like that.
Yeah.
Between Melbourne and the Gulf. Yep.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Art Gallery of New South Wales. At 1 p.m. there will be a free guided tour of the Contemporary Art Collection. This tour will depart from the information desk on the ground level.
That's in 3 minutes, so we're already overstaying our welcome. I should have finished about 10 minutes ago, but we'll keep going. So, beg your pardon? What if he appropriated that?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So, like, what if he got a picture of Uluru and then just put him in that, incorporated the person into
I still don't understand your question. What if, say it again slowly.
So, you said it wasn't in near Uluru. I'm just saying, what if he incorporated the person into that type of landscape?
Incorporated that person into an Uluru landscape?
Yeah.
What if?
Yeah.
And what can I answer? What can I answer? Well, maybe. I mean, I think I understand your question. If he's being historically accurate, to the expedition, then it wouldn't be anywhere near Uluru, because it went up from Melbourne to the Gulf of Carpentaria, and Uluru's over here, and the route is that way.
Yeah.
But you're asking, what if he pretended they went over here? Then what's my answer to you? I don't know how to answer you. You tell me the answer. Okay. I'll ask you the question. So, along this wall here, we've got Albert Tucker and Arthur Boyd. And they're both important mid-20th century artists. This is a weird painting called Antipodean Head. It's sort of trying to symbolize something about the relationship of Australia and its inhabitants. This, on its side, it looks almost perhaps like a map of Australia, if you use your imagination a lot. But it's also like a tree trunk, and it's like a face that's been turned into a tree. Is it saying something about the relationship of people to their landscape if they stay here long enough? Arthur Boyd, very interested in relating biblical themes to the Australian landscape. He lived in the Shoalhaven area of the bush around Wollongong, and this one is called Lion's Head in a Cave and Rainbow. And there's definitely the Australian bush around here. There's a feral ram, there's bushfire, and he's got a rainbow and he's got a lion in a cave there. Very mysterious symbolism, but very powerful painting. So let's move through this way. So, in the introductory lectures in the last few weeks, I've talked a lot about the mountain has its own meaning. I've talked about the way that D.H. Lawrence referred to a formless beauty and talked about seeing nature in and for itself rather than trying to impose anything on it. And we looked at David Maloof's description in the passage from Fly Away Peter, where Ashley Crowther allowed the landscape to be as it was, not like his forefathers saw it, wanting to shape it into a European landscape. And in that context, I showed you some paintings by Fred Williams. And here are four paintings by Fred Williams. Now, if you came in off the street and saw these paintings, you wouldn't spend much time with them. You'd think, what on earth are they, and how do they relate to anything? They're all Australian landscapes. And they're Australian landscapes that Fred Williams has painted in ways that were never painted like this before. A new way of looking at the world. By the way, Fred Williams became internationally very celebrated for his works of art, for his combination of colours, relationship of the forms to each other, and kind of an abstract way of seeing the world. But, you know, it raises questions, how do we see the world anyway? I mean, we tend to see the world habituated by what we see on the television screen, habituated by how we read things in the media. There are so many different ways of seeing the world. If you look over here at the Aboriginal way of seeing the world, they don't see the world anything like we do. They have symbols for water holes, for walking tracks, for animals. Their world is radically different to the way we see things. And for that reason, we find it very difficult to enter that world and know how to read it. But a lot of people find this very difficult to know how to enter it and how to read it. And when we come to read David Maloof's novel Fly Away Peter, you'll see there that his description of landscape takes a lot of effort to understand how he's seeing the landscape, taking you beyond the surface into something much deeper, something below the surface, some experience or feeling that is produced or released. So we're really here moving now into the later 20th century. And it's interesting that these are actually put into the gallery here next to some indigenous art here, as if there's almost suggested there's some kind of link or resemblance between these two. And I think there is. I mean, Fred Williams is kind of looking at the pattern rather than the detail. And he's looking at the colour rather than the the colour of the overall rather than the colour of particular details. And maybe the same can be said about Indigenous art. We could spend a lot of time discussing all this, I know, but we want to move on so you can get to your lunch and I can get to my lunch. So we've got a few more things to look at around here. So, first of all, over here. Now, this is by one of Australia's most celebrated, perhaps infamous artists, Brett Whiteley. He died of a heroin overdose at the age of just over 40, I think. He died in the late 70s. And that is a painting of his view from his house at Lavender Bay in Sydney. There's the Harbour Bridge in the top left-hand corner. There's Luna Park down just below the Harbour Bridge. There's the balcony from his house. I know his house well because I actually used to live in a flat over on this side looking down over the harbour. There's a heron flying across the darkened landscape. There's a tree here which looks like somebody's backside, and that's quite intentional. Brett Whiteley used to see everything as kind of fleshy bodies. He was a very sensual artist. And in fact, his whole depiction of the landscape is very sensual. The deep blues, the blends of light blues, and there's the opera house in the very top left-hand corner, look. So it's a very modernistic, stylized landscape, which at the same time suggests a sort of tremendous passion for the physical world. He had that. And that's not one of his best paintings. You have a look at some of his other works. They're brilliant. If you're going to stay with me with literature for a third year, if you're lucky, I'll take you to the Brett Whiteley studio. I'm taking my third years there in a couple of weeks. Brett Whiteley studio in Surrey Hills. He's got some fantastic work there. Now, this might be difficult to tune into, but if you look down the other end of the hall, there's something more difficult to tune into. And it's interesting that these two things are put together here. I'd love to be a gallery director and make these decisions about what goes with what. So what you've got at the end there is one of the most amazing paintings from the Papunya School in the centre of Australia. And if you had the good fortune to go and see the exhibition we had at the gallery at Strathfield, Earth Song, they were like this, but they were much smaller. And here you've got this massive canvas. And also one on the right, when you get closer there, you'll have a look. It's pretty incredible. And their way of looking at the world, again, I mean, you know, the only thing we've got to compare it with is Kim Scott's Dead Man Dance, some of the Aboriginal poetry we looked at, some of the Aboriginal writing we looked at. That's a sort of a beginning of an understanding of how they see the world beyond the merely physical. And they tend to, you know, give such importance to, you know, physical objects like water holes, like tracks between waterholes, like ceremonial places where women and men have their ceremonial sacred gatherings. And all that comes together in this amazing canvas. And one's first response to it, my response, is the physical beauty of it. I mean, it's a bit like looking at a wonderful rock, like a wonderful natural shape. And yet when you get closer to it and see the colours in there, you're sort of overwhelmed by the, you know, the amazing sort of detail, ritualistic quality. And when you see these paintings being done by the artist to sit on the ground, you know, using the most basic of implements, it's amazing how these things come together. Let's go and have a closer look. Now you can see the Brett Whiteley from the same perspective. Turn around and have a look at the Brett Whiteley. So there's the Brett Whiteley. So who's the better artist? Brett Whiteley with his Lavender Bay, or Changala with his Jupiter well, or over here you've got Chuparula with his water being water, with his water and wallaby dreaming. Now, you know, we do stand here as complete ignoramuses. We do. We got no idea, and yet something in us responds to the magic of the textures of the colors, the relationships of the forms. We try and find a way of understanding it. We read some notes about, oh yes, this is the story about when they gathered the beetles and took them up to the waterhole here and then exchanged them from spears up here. Or the way that down here we had these dreaming tracks of these women who were taking girls off for their initiation. And over here are the men who went off into the countryside. You know, we can read all that sort of stuff, and still we don't fully kind of get it. But Bobby Wabalingani and Kim Scott, in the way that literature is able to introduce us to some of the mystery of the relationship to landscape, maybe that begins to help us tune into the way they're seeing the world. Has anybody got any comment at all on what I've just said?
You kind of say native animals.
Yep.
The patterns, like there's a kangaroo there.
Yep.
I don't know the thing in the center.
Might be something to do with the rainbow serpent even.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Certainly a big dominant form in the middle, isn't it? But that's the way you get into it. You kind of start looking at those details. I'm going to take you now down to the Aboriginal Gallery, just so you know that this gallery is not one floor, and just so I lose you somewhere, so that you can have to find your way out. Ask your way out. How do I get back to the top? No, it's worth going down to the gallery down there. It'll blow your mind with what some of the Indigenous artists have done. And there's a fantastic video on down there all day long about an Aboriginal woman and what she's trying to do with her work. So let's go down there. And this will be the last thing. Some of them, you know, they, as I said, they move paintings all the time. They add new ones and they take ones away. But actually now I come to think of it, the Ullswater early morning, I'm pretty sure, has been moved into the English 19th century gallery. So when you go into that first room that we were in that first room, instead of going down to the end where that big gum tree was, if you turned right immediately and then immediately left, you're in the 19th century European, and it's in there.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's in there. You got that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the entrance into the Yiribana Gallery. There are toilets over there, by the way, if you need them when you've finished. This painting up here on the wall has just been put up. I didn't see this last time I was down here a week or so ago. That amazes me, that painting. It's almost psychedelic in a way, but again, I think that's the wrong the wrong appreciation of it, psychedelic. But it's got that quality. The energy that comes out of that painting is just incredible. Maybe one has to start with talking about energy that comes out of works of art. The artist is putting so much in there. In a way, the symbolism and the particular things they're referring to are almost less important than the kind of energy that emerges. Like music, you listen to music, the energy that comes from music rather than what the music actually says. Let's come around this way. This way. So there's two paintings here by Ginger Riley. Now, all these paintings in here are worth having a look at. There's an overwhelming amount of material. Ginger Riley, this was done in the Northern Territory. It's a landscape painting which is depicting the river that flows through the country that he knows well, the clouds that bring heavy rain in the wet season. But there's a story attached to it. And I'll read some of this here. Ginger Riley depicts the dramatic rock formations known as the Ruined City that rear up out of the Gulf Country landscape. This is Riley's grandfather's country near the Nathan River. Riley has painted the rocky outcrops and surrounding land in bands across the painting while the river winds diagonally up to the sea. At the top of the painting, the bright blue sky, which is not differentiated from the sea at the mouth of the river, has large wet season clouds raining on the landscape. In Riley's work, clouds or the sun usually represent his mother. This place exists in Riley's creation knowledge as much as it does in the landscape. And you know, some of the descriptions of the landscape that we saw in Dead Man Dance, some of the descriptions that come through Bubby Wubbalingani's description or some of the other Aboriginal perspectives, they've got that same kind of quality in them. And Kim Scott, very cleverly as a writer, he's able to use the language of the Western imperialist, but he's also able to capture with his words, his symbolism, his colours, his sentence structure, able to capture some of the mystery and the magic of this kind of landscape. Now behind the wall over here, there's a video going that other students have sat and watched for 5 minutes. Really interesting, but kind of can help you tune in a little bit into what's going on here. So this really gives you a good introduction. You should just move in a little bit here.
My name is Vicky Rich. I'm a Sherwood of Ireland from the northeast of Tasmania, and I'm an artist. I work very much with kelp, natural fibres. I first started to work with the kelp in the early 1990s. I went to a cultural luncheon at Rewana, which is part of the University of Tasmania, and I'm taught by all this work with kelp and natural fibres. Worked first off with the water carriers, which are made from kelp. And I've developed and pushed that material to a different level. Like I've done craft and things, but never really looked at art and that whole meaning of what I convey in that work. So it's a really important start to me. I didn't finish high school, I got straight out of art class when I was in high school. if they hold meaningfully, and I wasn't sure what medium I wanted to work in, what studio, and I did that whole, you know, studio survey thing, and because of all the toxic elements in it, I don't want to work within that, I want to work with things that are available in nature and that aren't toxic. I probably made two or three water carries, and then I started to really experiment with those techniques. So this is the kelp that I collected from the northeast coast, Cape Portland area. This is how it is when you collect it. So it's very soft, a bit like leather. If I didn't make work, I think I'd be a bit mad. I probably am a bit mad, and it's that whole thing of processing and being able to have an understanding of history, of myself, of where I fit in the world, and to be able to carry that with me. Really important that my children, my grandchildren understand and know that stuff, whereas we've all had to really research and look at that whole connection to place and who we are. So this is it in its drive state, so after it's worked, so this is about 3 or 4 days after, so it becomes very fragile in its manner. Traditionally it was threaded onto the tea tree and then little string handles were added on for it to be carried, and they would vary in size. Like I knew about my great-grandparents being taken to the islands and all that, but didn't know a lot about the materials and that. Like I can remember my great-uncle just recently telling me about when he lived on fingers and his mum making the shell necklaces and yeah, so it was quite close, that whole, I've got my family to live in it, and so that whole thing of protecting was very much in our family. Mm-hmm. This piece is a combination of the leaf of the pelt, and then this is the stalk, so I slice that down into thin slices and then use it as adornment. I'm very passionate about the environment, so lots and lots of my work now goes about having a survival and about how important it is to protect and respect the environment. I go back to country and I was shown this beautiful spot by one of our elders. She was a shell necklace maker, she's since passed. And she used to collect shells there, so I've gone to her up.
So does anybody have any questions at all about anything that you have to do? No? All clear? If you do have any questions, just send me an email. I'll try and answer the best I can. But welcome to stay here. And, you know, good if you can go back and have a look at a couple of the other paintings that really struck you. See if you can write something down about that. At least get the title, etc. You might look up some details on Google. Yep. Good. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
See you. Yeah, you too. Yep. Yeah, sure. No, not necessarily. Yeah, similar stuff. No, you don't have to be confined to what I've told you. Yeah.
With the each room, do we have to pick the ones from this list, or can
you can pick anything, but that's a starting point. The ones I talked about today would be a starting point. Okay,
good.